Hello and welcome to Gribbing the Filth with me, Tom Sharp. Today it's time for a lofty subject, as it were. We're going to be having a chat about something very readily apparent to us, because it's an aspect of insect life that rather jumps out and presents itself, although obviously it doesn't jump out, it flies out, it's insect flight. We'll also be delving into notions of millennia-long developments and considering wild unknowns, speculating, delving into genetics and so on and so forth. All that lovely, hefty stuff, made concrete by the flies that worry about our faces, and the bees that drone about, and the moths, and so on, and so on, and so on. Flying, flight, is interesting. Birds do it, bees do it, but educated fleas do not do it. Why not? After all, a flea is an insect, like a bee, like a fly. Why is it not up there on the wing with the rest of its mates? In this episode, we'll hear some answers, and we'll figure out what's so special about insect flight, and we'll look at how flight varies within the insect class, and we'll examine and admire the variation that exists within that field, and we'll whiz off on various other flights of fancy. Swooping in to join me and to educate me on the subject of insect flight is Abby Hayes. It was fabulous to have the opportunity to enjoy their expertise and to chat about something about which they are so passionate and eloquent. As such, I think you'll enjoy it too. So please join me in discussing insect flight with Abby Hayes. I'm thrilled to say that joining me today is Abby Hayes, NSF Postdoctoral Fellow and Evolutionary Entomologist. Abby, how are you today?
Great, thanks. How are you, Tom?
I'm well. I'm very, very well. I'm excited to have a chat about insect flight, because that's what we're talking about, insect flight. And it's nice to be able to talk about something that is quite distinct from a specific type of insect, or from it's nice to have that kind of that lovely variation in the kind of things I get to talk about. And I've been giving it some thought today, thinking about flight and wings, and these are things that are rushing through my head, so it's exciting to dive into it. But I wonder, could you tell me a little bit about, before we buzz gently into that field, what's been your sort of your relationship with insects and with invertebrate life, and kind of how that, you know, you've come to this fantastic place in your career, but what journey has brought you there?
That's a great question and a great place to start. So I am assigned female at birth, but identify as a non-binary or gender fluid person. And when I was growing up, I was really into bugs. Like when I was maybe 4 or 5, I was really into just going outside and looking at bugs and, you know, picking them up, much to my parents' chagrin. And my mom's really not into bugs. In fact, she's rather afraid of several of them. But my dad is relatively outdoorsy, so I kind of think that's where it came from. And I was never really discouraged by my family from pursuing my interest in nature and insects. But when it came to being at school, I was very heavily discouraged from pursuing this interest. What I would usually do at recess was go outside and hang out in like the soccer field and catch little beetles or bees or whatever. You know, I'd save my little wrappers from snack time to catch the bugs in and look at them. And in maybe like first or second grade, my teacher started becoming quote unquote concerned with my social development and actually tried to intervene with my parents and my guardians to actually like kind of shuttle me more towards playing with the other girls, but I've never really been into the whole like playing house or make believe kind of stuff. So for a while I did kind of like leave my love for insects. So my parents actually changed me schools to a like more, it was still a public school, but it was much more into like letting kids go at their own pace and pursue their own interests, lots of field trips and outdoors time. So I was kind of able to like fill that niche without directly like pursuing bugs. But once I got to high school and started taking biology classes, I was like, ooh, science is really cool. This is awesome. And then I got to college and I actually started doing research on salamander ecology. So not at all insect related.
Sure.
But as you can imagine, salamanders eat lots of bugs. So part of that job was identifying insects, and I got really like interested in figuring out what these different families of insects were in my samples. And then one day when I was leaving campus after many, many hours of looking through a microscope at little aquatic insects, I found a really large sphingid moth on the wall, so a hawk moth. And I knew enough about bugs at that point to know that the hawk moths are the ones that make those really big hornworm caterpillars, the like hot dog size ones with the little tail. And that's actually one of the main insects my mom is afraid of and passed on that fear to me. So I was kind of grossed out and afraid of hornworms. She claims it's because her brother used to pick them off the tomato plants and like smash them on the fence and it really grossed her out, which I think is understandable. But I realized it's not a rational fear, right? Like this caterpillar literally could not hurt me if it wanted to, right? They're little like soft, squishy hot dog kind of things. They, yeah, no way could hurt me. So I decided I was going to get over this fear. I caught this moth and decided I was going to mate her. So I put her in this big, like, rearing cage that was mesh left over from a former entomologist at my institution. And she laid eggs all over in it. And that gave me a chance to actually learn a little bit about their biology. So typically they emerge from the pupa and mate right there. They don't fly first. And so she had already mated and was laying eggs. And so my senior year of college, I raised about 300 caterpillars. So lots of getting food plant for them and watching them grow up. And I got really, really interested in how they used their phenotype, which is like the way they look, right? So they're green and they have little kind of stripes on them and they have a triangular pointy head. And they use all of those features along with their behavior to really mimic a leaf. So they would kind of hang off a leaf. And again, they have that pointy head. They have little stripes that look like the veins of the leaf. So they really effectively are using both their appearance and their behavior to form a camouflage. And I also noticed there was like a light green caterpillar color and a dark green caterpillar color. And from that moment on, I was sold on understanding why bugs look the way they do. And that has led to my PhD and now my postdoc. So my main interest is basically, why does that bug look the way it does? And I'm using bug in a very broad sense. I'm interested in lots of different arthropods. So yeah, that's kind of why I'm not like a one taxa specific person. I'm more of a broad question person. So I've worked on quite a variety of insects in my relatively short career.
That's fantastic. I'm interested if, you know, it sounds like your parents were, even if your mum's not necessarily a fan of insects, they were kind of encouraging of that passion. So when you drifted, it sounds almost by accident, back into looking at insects from as an academic, what was their response when that kind of reared its head again?
Yeah, so I think my dad's always been really excited about outdoorsy stuff. And I think that kind of helped temper my mom's fear. And, you know, I think being around someone who is passionate about that kind of stuff is enough to make you think a little bit more. So while my mom is afraid of a lot of these different bugs, she still appreciates them. So I think that is kind of what prevented her from discouraging me to the point where I would not pursue it. But I do see often parents pass on these really extreme phobias or fears to their children about arthropods. So usually when I do outreach events, I get all kinds of questions from the parents that have a connotation of negativity, right? And so it's kind of clear like where this comes from, although there's some argument that maybe there's an evolutionary component. But largely I would say they've been supportive the whole journey. My mom was not super happy when I changed my PhD study organism to crickets, because grasshoppers and crickets are one of her big kind of like ookie groups that freak her out. But she was supportive the whole time and just doesn't look too close at the pictures when I give presentations.
Sure. That's interesting that that's one of the, I would have thought that of all the insects, the grasshoppers and the crickets are some of the more kind of charming creatures.
I think so too, but she had a grasshopper fly and land on her face when she was a little kid. And that was a very formative experience. Yeah.
This is a very, very brief anecdote and a very, very bad anecdote, which I'm not going to tell, which is that I was recently in a countryside area and I saw some big grasshoppers.
And that's okay.
But one of them, it was flying, and because of the size of these things, it was sort of, it could be mistaken for a bird, but it was a good old size, and it flew around, and it knocked into a bridge and sort of stunned itself briefly, but it was okay. That's my grasshopper anecdote. But
they're not that good at flying, like aiming.
Well, and that's exactly where we're going now. So flying. If we were going to discuss insect flight, one thing that I was realizing in the run-up to talking about this is that little facts that you'd always been aware of, but never sort of got a kind of firm grasp on before, come to sometimes. And one thing that I realized is insects, as far as I can think, are the only arthropods, and in fact, the only invertebrates that have evolved flight, right?
That is correct. So flight is a pretty like rare evolutionary occurrence. It's only evolved four times in the entire history of life as we know it. And insects did it first. And as you've observed, they're the only invertebrate to have done it. Additionally, they're the only thing that evolved flight where it's not driven by hunting insects, right? Everything else that's evolved to fly has evolved to fly to eat insects that are already flying.
And the evolution of flight in other animals, in, I mean, birds are the obvious one, right? But the evolution of those flights is quite distinct from, you know, it's not related to the evolution of flight within the insects, right?
Yeah, so it's distinct evolutionary origins in these four groups. So the two that often come to people's minds are bats and birds, right? Those are the two extant examples that are not insects. The fourth example, besides insects, bats, and birds, are the pterosaurs, which are like a weird reptile dinosaur kind of thing, which is not my area of expertise, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. But they evolved flight when dinosaurs were evolving, so like long time ago. Insects predated that by like 100 million years. So insects have been flying for a really, really long time. And that's part of the issue with figuring out how it happened.
Well, if we're going to discuss that, then maybe one thing we need to do is to get a grasp on what insects are in terms of where they came from and the story of insects as a whole. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is actually something that has been kind of, our understanding has changed in the last 10 to 15 years about where insects came from in terms of the tree of life. So we used to think that, right, we have all these arthropods, which are all jointed, legged, exoskeleton-bearing animals that molt. Those are within the larger group of ecdysozoa, which are things that molt their outer exoskeleton kind of bit. So there are lots of different ecdysozoans, like nematodes and stuff like that are included. Then we get into arthropods and we have like the millipedes, the centipedes, the arachnids, the crustaceans, the insects, right? Those are kind of like the main players, the trilobites, which are sadly extinct. And so we used to think that the crustaceans and the insects were sister taxa, meaning that those were the most closely related out of the arthropods. So a lot of people think, you know, eating a bug is like eating a spider, but really eating a bug is like eating a shrimp. So that's my little plug for entomophagy here. But yeah, now we actually think that the insects evolved directly from the crustaceans. So essentially, insects are crustaceans that have evolved to live on land, and over their evolutionary trajectory of evolving to live on land, they've developed things like wings.
Among the insects, I mean, you mentioned pterosaurs, I think. Pterodactyl being the kind of the one that people know, and it has that fascinating prefix from optera, right? And within the insects, you have things like the hymenoptera, the ants and the wasps, and you have the coleoptera, and you've got that little linguistic tag, optera, meaning wing, right?
Yes, yeah. So a lot of them derive their names directly from having wings.
Yeah, so is the possession of wings quite a defining trait of the insects?
That's a great question. So there are insects that exist today that are still around that evolved like long, long time ago and never evolved wings. So there are insects out there that are called primitively wingless. So if you think of something like a silverfish or a bristletail, those are never going to develop wings. They're considered primitively wingless, meaning they evolved never to have wings, as opposed to other insects we'll talk about later, which have secondarily lost their wings. So their ancestors had wings, they don't anymore, versus never had wings. So again, there are ones that exist, and those are a pterygota is what they're called, so don't have wings.
Yeah.
And anything that evolved after that in insects are called pterygotes, have wings. So that's kind of the broad like separation. There's a pterygota, the insects without wings, and then there's pterygota, the insects with wings. And then there's even this other like weird division if you go a little bit further back, where there are non-insect hexapods, which I'll just give a brief shout out to. So things like Columbula, right, the springtails, those are technically not insects, but they are hexapods. So they're an arthropod, they have six legs, right? They have all the fixins of an insect, except their mouth parts are wrong. So they are considered this kind of like lineage separate from the true insects, although still a hexapod, and they do not have wings. So that's my other little wingless, not an insect, but still an arthropod shout out. But as far as the insects, true insects go, there's the silverfish and the bristletails.
Presumably there's things like the ants and stuff, right? But within the ants, you still have winged reproductives and things like that.
Yeah, so within the winged insects, there are a lot of different kind of like life histories or evolutionary histories leading to what we see now in the form of wings. So if you think of like a grasshopper or a cricket or a butterfly, I mean, maybe butterfly is not the best example. We'll go with a grasshopper, okay. Right? They have four wings. And historically, actually, a most ancient winged insect that's still extant now is the mayfly. And if you look at a mayfly, really all four of its wings are pretty similar. Same with a dragonfly or a damselfly, right? These are all pretty ancient insects that evolved wings a long time ago. And they're more or less all the same. But over evolutionary time, some of those wings have been specialized. So you can even think of actually a grasshopper where those front wings are a little bit thicker. Those are actually called tegmen. They have their own fancy name. And they function a little bit like in a beetle, right? The front pair of wings have evolved into the elytra, which are what make that kind of shell-like feature when a beetle has its wings closed. And so there's been a lot of different kind of evolutionary innovations when it comes to insect wings. So the most ancient of the insects to evolve wings, as I mentioned, the mayflies and the dragonflies and the damselflies, you might notice they don't fold their wings behind their back, right? They're always out. Sure. Right. The damselflies can put them back in a certain way, but they're not like flat against their back, like if you think about a beetle or something like that. And that could be considered kind of a negative, right? If you're trying to like crawl into a little burrow or something, you're going to wreck your wings if they're just always out. And so the evolution of wing folding is considered to be a pretty significant kind of point in wing evolution. But one of the perhaps more interesting points of wing evolution, I think, is actually how they flap the wings, like the musculature that underlies the flight itself. So in the more ancient groups, like the mayflies and the dragonflies, it's direct flight. So there's actually muscles in the thorax moving the wings themselves. And this is part of why dragonflies are such exquisite flyers, right? You've probably seen them really zipping around. They can fly backwards. They can fly really aerial acrobats, and that's partially due to the fact that they control their wings independently, right? So it's not like one motion controls all four wings, as opposed to the more modern, I guess the more recently evolved is maybe how I should phrase that, the more recently evolved insects out there, their wings are powered by what's called indirect flight muscles. So what those are actually doing is flexing the thorax. And by flexing the thorax, it causes the wings to move up and down. And that saves a lot of energy. And then on top of that, there are insects that have actually evolved wing linkages. So a butterfly is a good example, right? When it flaps its wings, they all four flap, right? You never see them flapping the different wings at different times. And that is actually caused by a physical linkage between the front and the back wing. So there's a little structure in there that kind of hooks the two together. And wasps and bees have a really similar thing, but it's more like a bunch of little tiny hooks. So very similar to the human-developed Velcro. So if you look at some microscopic images of wasp wings, it is pretty much indistinguishable from Velcro. So another good example of insects innovating something. And then there are even other groups that have like lost wings, right? So Diptera flies, their order name, Diptera, right? Two wings. Wait a minute, I thought I just said bugs had four wings. What's going on? So in some groups, some of the sets of wings have been modified or even lost. In flies, one of the pairs of wings has become modified in what are called halteres, which are a little like drumstick kind of things that flap around. I've heard the story, if you get rid of one halter, the fly will just fly in a circle. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I've heard. So if you look at a fly, it really looks like it only has two wings versus if you look at a bee, it looks like it has four, right? So that's an example of kind of modification of the wings after they've evolved, right? So they all have wings, but what the wings are doing and what they look like is a little bit different. Fleas are another good example, right? You've never seen a flea with wings. Because they're entirely wingless. So the whole group of fleas have abandoned their wings. They don't need them. They hop instead. So that's another example of a kind of different strategy that's been taken up.
So you can't apply a narrative in terms of like development in and improvement, because evolution is shooting off in different directions and it's just doing its own thing, right? So you can't say the most modern kind of wing as opposed to the most ancient kind of wing. I mean, most ancient possibly you can, but it's not like the flies have the best wing necessarily. It's just that their wings have shot off in this way that benefits their particular lifestyle.
That's a really great point. So a lot of people get this idea that evolution is directional, right? It's trying to evolve the most efficient or best organism. But evolution can only select on what evolves via mutation, right? So some weird mutation has to happen somewhere for the feature to be present, for it to be selected on by evolution. So somewhere in the wing evolution, we'll just use flies as our example, some fly had a weird mutation that caused some of the wings to get little, right? Little halteres. That ended up being super beneficial for whatever reason. I'm not a fly biologist, so I can't really comment on that, but I'm sure someone else could. And from there, that success that was conferred by this new type of wing led to speciation of all these different groups.
A fascinating thing. I think the insect wing, to look at it, being quite a delicate thing with kind of the venation and things like that. And then you realize that within the wing itself, there are ways of identifying particular species within groups and stuff. It's the part of the insects that I find most intimidating to engage with, because talking about different veins and things within the wing, that's where my brain sort of starts to shut down.
I am definitely not in a different camp from you there. I call myself a generalist when it comes to identifying insects. I'll maybe get you to family. I can definitely get you to order, probably family. But beyond that, I'm probably going to find you a taxonomist that's specific to that group, because each group of insects, they use kind of different terminology, maybe not necessarily for the wing veins, right, but for different morphological features. So there's a lot of expertise that goes into knowing how to find these features or what the terminology is for these different features in the different groups. So wing veins and even like, so there's a whole part of taxonomy in flies where it's looking at where the different hairs are placed. That's a little too like in the weeds for me. I'm going to stick to my like weird evolutionary development genetics kind of field.
If you're enjoying Grubbing in the Filth, come and wallow with me in the horrendous world of social media. You can follow Grubbing in the Filth on Instagram and Twitter. On Instagram, it's at Grubbing in the Filth, and on Twitter, it's at GITF Podcast. You can also email grubbinginthefilth@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, whether it's your own perspective, to share a story, a photo, or what have you. Well, let's jump into the development itself then. Evolution of flight and the evolution of a lot of things, when you try and think about it, because these vast amount of times are involved and because it just seems such complexity, you know, it plays people up, right? And that's why there has been a great deal of anger towards the notion of evolution and stuff, is because the idea of something like a wing evolving from a lack of wings is just it's difficult to get your head around, right? Because, you know, there was a time when insects didn't have wings, then they did. Do we have any sense of kind of what that transitional phase is?
That's a great question. So part of the issue with trying to figure out where insect wings came from is that we have a pretty incomplete fossil record. So if we had a nice fossil record that, you know, showed a little gradual development of wings, you know, maybe we would be able to tell more information about what tissues these wings are evolving from, right? Again, it's not just an arm in the wing or in the insects. We don't really know what feature these wings evolved from. So because of preservation bias, right? If you think about a bug in general, they're little, they're pretty soft and squishy. They don't have like hard mineralized bones. So they get preserved less and in less complete forms than some other organisms do. And so we don't really have a clear idea of even when wings evolved. There's some kind of controversial fossil record things that people are not sure if it's really a winged insect or not. So kind of even when exactly it did evolve is up for debate. but it was, you know, long time ago, which is kind of the other part of the issue. Aside from not having fossils of this, there's nothing around now that represents that kind of transitional phase between the wingless insects and the winged insects. So really, it's been kind of a hard question to address. But now that we have all these cool molecular tools that have been developed in the last, like, 30, 40 years, we have a new way to kind of look at, like, a new toolkit to look at the insects that exist now to try to infer how they got to where they are. So the largest focus of that has been in Drosophila, right? They're kind of like the poster child for insect genetics.
The go-to, right?
Yeah, they're the go-to. We know so much about what's going on in them. They're the most extensively studied. We have lots of genetic tools that we can use in them.
And that's the fruit fly, right?
Yes. Yeah. So Drosophila melanogaster is the most commonly used species, but lots of people work on lots of different species of fruit fly now. And so when they first got access to these molecular tools, what they did is they looked at the genes that were expressed in the wings, right? So they were like, okay, let's start to investigate the genetic underpinnings of this unique tissue. So they said, okay, here are the genes that are only expressed in the wings and not any other part of the fly. And then they did some genetic manipulation and actually like messed with the function of those genes, and they were able to effectively delete the wings. So that led them to conclude these are wing genes, right? So if you look up the term wing gene, you'll see lots of different genes pop up, vestigial, blah, blah, blah. And those are the genes that people have then taken and looked for in other insects and in other body parts to try to figure out where did the wing come from, right? Maybe if we can find these wing genes in other tissues that aren't wings, we can figure out, oh, that's right, where the wing came from, right?
Sure, sure.
So this concept is called serial homology, searching for repeating segments, the same tissue that has evolved into different parts, right? So the idea is we can look across segments. Not all the segments of an arthropod have wings. So maybe we can get information by looking across the segments and across the tree of life and across evolutionary history to get at where these wings came from. And so this has been something that's been going on for decades, right? I'm not like the first person to look at these genes or anything like that. And in fact, they have largely found that these wing genes are in wings. But I will note that fruit flies are a little bit unique in their body. If you think about what they look like, they're like a little ball with a bunch of little sticks poking out, which are their legs, and then two kind of flappy bits, right? Two bilayer epithelia, which means two cell sheets, and that's the wing, right? It's just a little flap. But there's no other part of a fruit fly that's composed of two sheets of cells like that. There's no other double-layered epithelial feature, aka flappy parts is what I'm calling them. And so my project I'm working on right now is looking at these wing genes in non-wing flaps. So I found a bunch of different bugs that have different flappy parts. So my favorite example is leaf-footed bugs, the coreids. They have these really cool back legs where the tibia have been expanded into these leaf-like features, yes, which are used for different things, which I can talk about in a second if you want. But essentially, my question is, in my project, are these wing genes in these flaps? So I'm looking at the gene expression. And if I mess with these genes, do both the wings and the non-wing flaps get messed up, or do they respond differently? So that's kind of the main approach now, with the idea being maybe some of these wing genes that have been identified and used to figure out, oh, perhaps it evolved from XYZ feature. Maybe they're really just genes underlying this tissue type rather than the function.
You explain that really fantastically, so thank you. It's so essentially, We can't ever have a particularly clear sense of this. It's not one event, this process that happened millions of years ago, but there are some kind of, there are clues out there and we're starting to pick it together using these molecular tools. You just said that two layers of cells, is that right, for a wing?
Mm-hmm.
Is that, and we're talking literally two layers of cells, is that uniform across all the insects?
Yeah, so the wing veins are a little bit of kind of an exception to the two layers of cells thing. So new research has been coming out showing those wing veins actually are like like hemolymph is moving around the wing. So it's not like dead tissue per se. There's stuff going on there. But the spaces between the wing veins are just two sheets of cells, which is kind of wild to think about.
The filmy bit, right? So
yeah.
I was going to say, because we think of insect wings as being the kind of a go-to comparison when you're talking about delicacy, right? And a fly's wings and things like that. So these really are that delicate a tissue.
Yeah, so I would say things like beetles that have the like thickened kind of wing, sure. That's probably sort of an exception to this rule because it's been modified over evolutionary time to serve kind of a different purpose, right? To have some protective feature. But if it's kind of that like gossamer, shimmery insect wing, it really is that thin. And this is also why a lot of kind of material scientists are really interested in insects as well, because how do you make something that, you know, flexible and soft that is able to fly you around in the sky? Like, what? Humans definitely should get on that.
Oh, fingers crossed we do. And another thing you said was to do with something I hadn't really thought about, but yeah, the wings always occur on the thorax, right? And they always occur, you said, on the same section. And I was wondering, on the same segment rather, I was wondering, are there any other things where we can kind of, I know with insects and with taxonomy and with anything like this, it gets so frustrating because you can always say, this is generally true, but are there any things like that where we can say, among all the insects, this is true of their wings?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, I would say of winged insects, the wings are always on the second and third segment of the thorax. So the insect is arranged into head, thorax, abdomen, as I'm sure you and many listeners will know. But the thorax itself is actually made up of three different segments. And each of those segments has one pair of legs. So that's how you get six legs, right? And the second and third segments of that thorax have a pair of wings each. And so it's usually like the wings on a whole segment that get modified. So in the example of the beetle shell kind of thing, the elytra, right, it's the front two wings that have been modified in the shell. And the second two are still kind of soft and flexible in most of the insects, most beetles rather. And something I want to note is that there are actually ways to get that first thoracic segment to grow wings. So we can actually induce wing growth and make an insect with six wings. And the way we can do that is there's a specific gene, a Hox gene is what it's called, in the first segment of the thorax that tells it you're the first segment, right? So it's an identity gene that tells it this is your segmental identity. And because it's received that information, it knows not to grow a pair of wings. And so if we mess with that gene, that segment forgets that it's first and it kind of defaults to the second or third one, right? So that's kind of what we think is like the ancestral state. So getting back to your question about kind of like more or less evolved, ancestral is kind of the like way back when trait. Derived is the more like modern, more recently evolved trait. But that, again, doesn't mean anything about like how good something is. I just want to put that out there. There's no commentary on function or judgment here. But yeah, so the more derived trait is having less than four wings in insects. So things like flies, right, where one of the sets of those wings has been modified, that would be derived, versus the ancestral state is the four nice big wings like you see on a mayfly or a dragonfly. But we can kind of go in with our molecular toolkit and alter these things to see what can we get this bug body to do and what does that mean about how these things evolved. So one of the ways we've been looking at this is, as I mentioned, messing with the gene expression and looking at what happens. And so people have been taking this beyond insects, right? So as I mentioned, we now think insects evolved from crustaceans. So what happens if we go and look for wing genes in crustaceans? Can we find them? The answer is yes, we can. So that's part of trying to figure out where these things evolved from, is thinking about where these different organisms fall in evolutionary history and in the tree of life, and using these molecular tools to assess where did this gene first appear? Where did this function first come from? And what tissues are we finding them in? And what functions are in those tissues? And by kind of piecing together these little different parts like detectives, we're able to get a more clear picture of maybe where the wings evolved. So historically, there's been two main hypotheses. Either the wings evolved from nothing, right? They're a novel feature. They just appeared. Or they evolved from something the insects already had, right? So it's just a modification. Mm-hmm. So most of my career, a lot of people have come up to me to talk about the idea of modification. For a long time, the thought was maybe wings evolved from gills. So as I mentioned, mayflies are some of the oldest insects to have evolved wings. When they're nymphs, they have these nice flappy gills on their abdomen that look an awful lot like a wing. It's a little sheet of cells. It's got some veins in it. They can flap it around even. Like it has musculature attached to it. So that was a pretty obvious, like, hello, this is where wings came from. But if you think about it, right, they're all on the abdomen. They're not on the thorax. Mayflies have wings. They don't form from the gill, right? So that was kind of an issue. And then actually some molecular hypothesis, or some molecular work rather, has validated these hypotheses, and some has kind of not. So it's a little bit still up in the air. But one thing I do want to say is the underlying musculature that actually flaps the gills is pretty different than how wings flap. So that hypothesis is kind of like fallen by the wayside a little bit in favor of the newer hypothesis, which kind of falls, honestly, it falls a little bit in between the novel and the modification hypotheses. But essentially, what if the wing came from the side of the bug, right? So you can think of a bug like a top half and a bottom half that kind of connect. So what if the wing has just grown out of the sides of the bug? So there are lots of ancient insects and fossils that have what are known as paranodal lobes, these kind of like weird lobe-like features on that first thoracic segment. That being said, they're present in nymphs and adults. So that's another potential evolutionary origin. But more recent molecular work has actually suggested it might be some combination of a lot of these different hypotheses, which kind of gets at this idea that science is not really like a black or white thing, right? It's often a very complex, nuanced answer. There's not one clear wings came from X tissue. What we think now is called the dual origin hypothesis. So we think the top and the bottom half of the insect kind of fused and started to make the wing. And there's also the hypothesis that maybe some of the genes involved in legs are involved in wings, and that's where the articulation and jointedness and musculature underlying flapping has come from. So we're still not really sure, which I think is kind of the coolest thing about this topic, is we don't know, right? We don't know where wings came from. And I don't know if we'll ever know as humans, because we can't go back in time to, you know, before the dinosaurs were around to watch insects evolve wings. And as I've mentioned, we have a limited fossil record. So all we can really do is kind of piece together the parts that we can using the tool sets that we have as human beings. So we might get an answer, we might not. I really think it's going to be kind of a combinatorial type of answer of like, well, it's probably a little bit of all of these things.
Yeah.
And I think that also kind of points out the flaw in how we approach science as humans, right? We're always going to be approaching it from a human perspective. So how did insects evolve wings? Again, we're really limited by when we're living and what tools we have. So I think something that's underappreciated about scientific research is there's a lot of uncertainty that might never become certain, and that's okay. And it's kind of cool, I think.
Yeah, and I guess that even if you had certainty, that would be quite a complicated form of certainty, right? Because, yeah, it's not going to be... One's instinct is to think that there's an answer which is clear and you can go, oh, wings evolved from this and we figured it out now. We've found this stone tablet that lets us know. But it's not that, right? It's going to be some kind of really complicated and potentially even unfathomable way that these things did come about, which we're not really going to be able to get our heads around.
Yeah, I think a good parallel would be like the colony collapse disorder that faces honeybees. People were thinking they were going to find like one causative reason, like this is why the bees are dying. But it turns out over the last like two decades of research, they've found like 70 plus things that are contributing. So it's very rare for us to have a kind of like one-to-one answer for things, which I think does make science a little hard to grapple with as a human. You know, we want to know the reason behind something. Like, that's the whole point of science, right? But I think really a more appropriate way to think about it is science is trying to approach the truth with the context that we have.
So it's frustrating from a kind of the part of us that likes reading murder mystery stories, because like I've figured out at the end, isn't necessarily going to be particularly conducive to good science.
Yeah, I have one friend that said that's like more of a taxonomist type of person who deals with very like this number of tarsal segments or that number of tarsal segments on this beetle. And he said the type of entomology that my colleagues and I do is like what they would do if they smoked a bunch of weed and looked at a bug and tried to figure out like why it looks the way it does. You know, it is very abstract and kind of hard to think about. But yeah, there's a pretty big community of people trying to figure out, you know, where these different novel structures come from. And wings are just one example, right? There's lots of different novel things that have evolved in arthropods. The evolution of silk is a good example, although that has happened like 20 plus times compared to the 4 wing evolution. So big shout out to flight being a pretty exclusive club. But yeah, there's lots of different features in insects that we don't really for sure know where they came from. Mm-hmm. And we're just trying our best with molecular tools and comparative, like looking across the tree of life, trying to figure out when it evolved and how it evolved. And it's, yeah, really an kind of up and coming field, as we've really only had the tools to be looking at these things since the 80s, which is pretty mind blowing to me.
You can now make donations to help offset the running costs of this podcast. If you're enjoying Grubbing the Filth and want to make a donation like a benevolent Victorian, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/grubbingcast, where you can also write a brief message if you so wish. Any donations are truly appreciated. Thank you. We talked about the things that are common within insect flight in terms of segmentation and stuff. What variation exists within insect flight? You've talked a little bit about the fact that the butterflies have these linked wings and the flies have their halteres and things. What other variation exists within the field of insect flight?
Well, this is, you're getting in my bread and butter now. So I actually did my PhD on a type of cricket where totally same DNA, like siblings, they could be twins, exactly the same DNA in their cells. And depending on what environment they experience while they're growing up, they will either grow long wings that are functional and can fly, as one would infer, or they develop these little tiny runty wings that do not work. So they're making a choice to grow a wing that's functional or not. And I'm using the term choice lightly here. I'm not trying to imply sentience per se, but more developmental trajectory choice. So I kind of frame it as the choice is stay and lay or fly away. So it seems pretty counterintuitive to have the option to fly and choose not to, right? As a human being, if I was offered the ability to fly, like, obviously I'm going to take it. Like, come on, crickets, what are you doing? So it's pretty wild to think about something choosing not to fly when that's an option. But the reason is pretty interesting, in my opinion. So we all, as organisms, have a limited amount of energy, right? This comes into play when you get sick and you feel really tired, right? Your immune system is kind of borrowing that energy from the rest of your body. We have a limited amount of energy. That's true of arthropods and all other organisms. So if you have a limited amount of energy, you have to kind of choose how to spend it. And the way you choose how to spend it will affect your fitness, which is kind of a weird term when used in evolution, right? As humans, when we say fitness, we usually mean like you're working out, you can run a mile or whatever, right? Or pump some iron. In the evolutionary context, fitness is about the amount of genetic information you're able to pass on to the next generation. So your fitness is how much reproduction you're able to accomplish in your lifetime. And so when you have a limited amount of energy as an organism, the evolutionary theory of life history theory says you're going to kind of spend that energy in ways that maximizes your lifetime fitness, so your reproduction. So if you're in a really, really good quality environment, you got lots of food, no competition, no predators, it's actually most fitness enhancing to stay in that environment and lay as many eggs as possible, right? You don't need to go anywhere. So why would you fly? You're going to develop these little tiny wings, no functional flight muscles. So as we've talked about, they have these flight muscles that flex the thorax and cause the wings to go up and down. In the short wing crickets, which is what the morph is called, that can't fly, these wings are not functional again. So the flight muscles, if you actually look in there, are like really tiny. They could not work even if they wanted to. So instead of putting all this energy into growing big functional flight muscles and big long wings, instead they invest a lot of energy into their ovaries. So they grow these really giant ovaries and have a lot of babies. The long-winged crickets kind of take the opposite approach. So in habitats that are really stressful, like you have really low amount of food, or there's a bunch of like neighbors around you that are jostling you, or there's a predator trying to eat you, your fitness is going to be most enhanced if you escape that environment before you reproduce. So the most fitness enhancing phenotype there is to, instead of pouring all your energy into your ovaries, you pour energy into developing these long wings and functional flight muscles. So they're very different looking muscles. They're like big and healthy and pink versus these little tiny white kind of non-existent flight muscles in the short wings. And again, these crickets can actually disperse to a new habitat type. And so in my PhD project, I actually looked at the amount of babies they have too, and the amount of ovary that they're, like the amount of their body mass that is their ovaries. And so over their lifetime, the short wing individuals do have more babies than the long wing individuals, but their ovaries actually do end up catching up to about the same percentage of their body mass, which is a horrifying 40%. Yeah, almost half of their body weight is ovary by like day 40 of their adult life. And it gets to the point where they can barely move. Like they get so distended full of ovaries that they can barely crawl. And so this has actually made us think it's probably most important that early life period, right before they're so bloated where a predator could really easily pick them off. So all of these things are kind of going together to present this really complex system where the environment you grow up in is really what determines if you're going to form wings and fly away, which obviously affects things like population spreading across a landscape. And you can also think about how these things might change with climate change, right? As the environment becomes more variable, maybe being able to switch between having wings or not will allow a species to survive.
That's quite incredible that you know, I asked about variation. I was expecting you to go, oh, some insects have wings that are nice and bright, some don't, and that which is fascinating. But there's variation even within specific species in terms of their wings.
Yeah, and it can come in even more extreme forms than the crickets. So the crickets are just long wings or little short wings. I mean, it is a pretty dramatic difference, you know, functionally. But there are other groups like aphids that take it to the next level where they
Ask about aphids.
Yeah, so they'll straight up just not have wings. So they do the same thing where they're kind of like, quote unquote, choosing between having wings or not. And in this case, it's just entirely absent. And something really interesting. So aphids are kind of a unique system. They're pretty weird when it comes to insects. And one weird thing that some of them do is they actually give live birth. So instead of just laying an egg, they have a little aphid that comes out of them. And it's actually a clone most of the time of the mother. And so in doing this reproduction, the mother is actually the one sensing the environment. So in the aphid system, it's not the environment that the individual is sensing, it's the environment her mom grew up in, which is pretty wild. And the males can actually also do the same wing or wingless thing, but it's controlled by a completely separate mechanism, which is a single genetic location. So they have an allele that's have a wing or don't have a wing, and what they inherit from their parent determines if they're going to have a wing or not. So that is called a wing polymorphism, where it's genetically determined, versus the females is called a wing polyphenism, where it's environmentally determined. So that's a within one life cycle, and this is seen across many orders of insects. So lots of hemipterans do this. As I've mentioned, there are crickets that do this. There are locusts that do this. So there's the phase polyphenic locust, but there are also ones thought to have a wing dimorphic component. There are beetles that do this. There are all kinds of insects that do this. And really, we only know about a small handful of them. So it's a very understudied topic, in my humble opinion.
Your humble and correct opinion. The aphids, I think, are one of the ones where they really speak to the idea that really bizarre and absolute strangeness and incredible stories and things like this are playing out in really, really mundane, like, they're not mundane. We know they're not because that we know they're cool and we like aphids. But these are the insects that are kind of like, oh, they're under the little tiny green one. Like, it's just under a leaf or whatever. Not kind of the flashier ones and things like that. And they do have this fascinating life cycle and way of being. So the aphids kind of being this kind of weird, semi-social, socially adjacent insect. The other kind of obvious example of insects where you have an interesting an interesting kind of occurrence of wings would be things like the ants, where you have the males and the queens that possess wings, and the workers do not possess wings. So is that, to ask it maybe an obvious question, why don't all ants have wings? Is that a case of having wings is a disadvantage for the worker ant?
That is a really good question. So the ant thing is similar to the termites, right? There's kind of this like social winged right. reproduction stage. And I know Miles talked to you about the kind of like broad, how the colonies reproduce. So I think it's really interesting that the reproductive ants only have wings for like a pretty short amount of time before they sure. de-alate, yeah. right? So
they eat them, right? Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, they just rip them off. And termites do the same thing. And there are actually crickets that do this too. So there are ones that do have long functional wings that will rip them off, which is wild to me. But, mm-hmm. you know, bugs got to do what they got to do. And so it makes sense, right? If you think about maximizing fitness, the queens and the kings need to get away from their home colony or their origin colony so that they're not competing against their own genetic lineage, right? That would be bad for their overall fitness, because even if they're not directly reproducing, if your sister reproduces, that still counts as fitness. That's kind of the idea behind honeybee colonies, right? Where not everyone's reproducing, or ants where not everyone's reproducing, is as long as someone's doing it, your genes are getting passed on, right? So they want to disperse to a habitat that's farther away from where they grew up, so they're not competing, and also so they're not mating with their siblings, right? We want genetic diversity. And so they disperse to a new place. But if you think about trying to live in the dirt with some wings, it seems like they'd get kind of crumpled up, right? And we've talked about how like soft and flexible a lot of the arthropod wings are. So there definitely are some arthropods that are ground nesting and do have wings, like bumblebees. But they have a really nice like wing folding system, and I think like they reproduce often enough that the workers, right, kind of have a turnover rate that if their wings do get damaged crawling around in the ground, like more workers will be there to replace them. And I think kind of the route ants have taken is crawling over flying, right? So instead of maintaining those wings and flying around to gather food like the bees and the wasps do, they've more taken the route of crawling and having a lot of crawling individuals to get food and maximize resources. As opposed to something that maintains flight, like a bee that's going to go visit flowers and then bring them back and can kind of range further, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Rapid fire wing related questions now.
Sweet.
Yeah. Best wing?
Oh, that's really putting me on the spot here. I mean, it's hard for me not to say something that's polyphenic, because like mm-hmm. the ability to adapt your wing to your environment is just really amazing. But I also think butterfly wings are particularly notable. So I've already talked about how they're linked together via like a physical mechanism. But the patterns and colors are really awesome on a butterfly wing, and they're pretty unique. So we've talked about how a lot of insect orders have "tera" in the name, right? Lepidoptera. Yeah. It means scaly wing. So the wings of butterflies and moths are really beautiful. And if you look really close, they're covered with those little scales, right? And that is an example of a modification of the wings, right? So just like beetles have evolved that little shell-like feature of the elytra, butterflies have evolved these kind of scale-like features on the wings. And if you've ever seen a clear-wing butterfly or clear-wing moth, they're actually just lacking those scales. So if you were to rub all the scales off of a butterfly wing, it would be that clear gossamer thing that you're used to seeing on an insect. So I think that's really cool. And their sister taxa is Trichoptera, the caddisflies, which literally means hair wing. And so if you look at their wings really close, they have kind of a similar feature, but it's not quite as like flat and well-developed as the butterflies. So they don't quite have the flashy, showy wings that butterflies do, but it's a pretty cool feature in my humble opinion.
So your scientific opinion, as a postdoctorate, is best wing butterfly wing?
Ooh, I don't know if I want to go on the record saying that. I'm going to say any polyphenic wing. That's my final answer. Anyone that can adapt their wing based on the environment they grow up in, that's pretty cool to me.
Okay, another sort of rapid to the point, but to direct, and it's a non-scientific question. Insects that have lost their wings, do you think that they are cool for doing it, or do you think that they are losers for doing it?
That's a great question. I think it's cool, but it kind of depends on the reason. So fleas and bed bugs come to mind for me, and I would put those in the loser category because I don't like them.
Sure.
I'm just being biased over here.
They scare the bejesus out of me. I think I'm developing a bit of a, not phobia per se, but certainly a hyper awareness of the possibility of bed bugs.
I will say the good thing about bed bugs is they don't transmit any diseases.
Sure.
So they're just annoying, but they're not like going to give you a lifelong disease like a tick or a mosquito.
Sure. But then that's an interesting one then, because bed bugs are hemipterans, they're bugs, and bugs do have wings, right? Or at least most of them do. So again, another example of a wingless species within a typically winged order.
Yeah, and actually Hemiptera are kind of a good example, not even kind of a good example, they are a good example of another type of modified wing. So we've talked about the elytra of a beetle, right? They have that like hardened shell kind of thing, which there are ones with pretty reduced elytra. So staphylinids, the rove beetles, look a lot like an earwig kind of thing, right? They have little, they're called brachypterous wings, which just means really reduced. So there are beetles out there that don't have the big shell. I just want to say that real quick. But wow, I just got sidetracked on the beetle thing.
It's all right. It's nothing wrong with the sidetrack.
What was I answering? What was the question you asked?
There wasn't a question. It was just general bedbug thoughts.
Yes. Okay. I got there. I got back to it. The modification of hemipteran wings. So the beetle, right? It's elytra, that thickened forewing. In Hemiptera, it's kind of easy to remember. It's called a hemielytra. So it's partially thickened. This is called sclerotization. So if you ever hear it called a sclerotized tissue, that just means it's thick and hard, basically. It's a chemical or physical component of the exoskeleton itself. And that gets like cross-linked. And that is what makes it hard and tough, which also makes it hard to get DNA out of. That's my fun fact. The tougher a bug tissue is, the harder it is to get the DNA out, which is a issue in my life sometimes. And so the front part of the front wings of Hemiptera is thickened and sclerotized, and the back part is still see-through. So this is a hemielytra, and the back part has a specific name, and the front part has a specific name, and then their back wings are totally membranous, right? So they're those kind of clear gossamer-type insect wings. And really, a lot of different hemipterans, you have to look at the veins of the back part of the front wing to tell what family it's in, even. So Hemiptera are a group that lots of wing specialty there, and a little bit beyond my pay grade. But the bedbugs and the aphids even are examples of hemipterans that have chosen to potentially lose their wings either entirely or in certain cases.
I'd like, if it's okay, to sort of flap away from wings. We talked a little at the start about your kind of your journey into entomology and how it was there were barriers put up, and how, no, for you as a child, there was a sense that because insects are, we file them into sort of a weird cultural camp, that's something that to be involved in that was to be avoided and was not to be encouraged. We're both involved with education in very different ways. My feeling is, of course, that people should be, and when I say people, I mean children, should be encouraged and nurtured into the things that interest them. And if that happens to be insects or arthropods or animals that we kind of, for one reason or another, have pushed into unpleasant or creepy or whatever, we should still encourage that, because my assertion is that they're not creepy and they're not weird. Well, they are weird, and that's part of their appeal, right? It's to be encouraged. And I think that there's a lot to be said for kind of outreach and talking about insects and trying to change our relationship with insects. That is its own thing. What I've kind of realised is that being interested in weird animals, from what you were saying, from your childhood, is that certain people are more entitled to be interested in weird animals. And I wondered if you could speak to that kind of, your relationship with that cultural fact.
Yeah, so I think I've more been reflecting on this as an adult than any like awareness I really had as a child. But as an adult, we'll just use the example of like, if you go into Target or Walmart or whatever and go into the kids section and look at the clothing that's available, you look at the girls' clothes versus the boys' clothes, you'll notice there's much more science and animal life represented in the boys' section.
Right.
It's very rare to find girls' clothes with bugs on it, which I will tell you, I very frequently am on the hunt. So I think I would know. And yeah, it's very often that for some reason, people who present as boys when they're young are encouraged to pursue nature, science, right? Get outside and be dirty and play in the mud and sticks and look at a bug. And, you know, it's not quite as encouraged for people who are presenting as female when they're children. So that was a big barrier for me personally. And I've heard from other people that they've had similar experiences. And I really think that as an educator, getting people to just appreciate that arthropods and insects are animals is a big part of the battle, right? So I'm always shocked the number of people that are shocked that arthropods are animals. They're like, an insect is an animal?
Mm.
What? Like, really? And I'm usually like, well, what else would it be?
Yeah.
You know, like, but the fact that we can't, or we don't, maybe is what I should say, identify with them, right? We don't empathize with them as humans because they look so different and they do such different things, leads to this kind of artificial separation of value, I would say, right? No one would just like step on a, you know, vertebrate that's in the way, but a lot of people are just going to step on a bug and think nothing of it. And so I think just getting people to think about them as living beings and as animals is really kind of the big part of the barrier to getting it to be accessible to everyone, right? There's lots of kind of cute, fluffy things on girls' clothing, and I think it's mostly like a value placed by humans. And the more we can appreciate that everything has value, right? All these things have evolved to fill their little role in the ecosystem. That's kind of another question I get a lot is, what's the point of that bug?
Mm.
What's the point of that? What's it doing? And it's like, what's the point of you? You know, what's the point of a human? There's no point to anything. And I think that goes back to this directional evolution, right? People think evolution is happening to serve some purpose or fill some need. But really, things are just out there existing in nature, doing what they're doing. And that's why I like to tell people most arthropods, like, will never interact with you, right? You're never going to see them. They're probably microscopic out in the dirt somewhere, you know? So I think appreciating that A, they're not malicious, right? And B, they're just animals doing their own thing will allow us to more authentically engage across these sectors of identity and not kind of put these harsh judgments on who should be able to access different animals. And I also want to throw out that there's also an angle of kind of like where you grow up, right? So I know there's been a lot of studies showing that if you grow up in a really big city and you don't have access to nature, you're less likely to pursue these types of things. And there's a large level of privilege in being able to get to nature if you live in one of these environments, right? So there's a lot of work going on to try to make like community gardens or like rooftop gardens to make this more accessible to people that can't just, you know, hop in a car and drive over to their state forest to take a hike. Sure. So I think like accessibility to green spaces is another really big important thing in making this a more equitable field.
Do you, as someone who is in the position you're in your career now, do those barriers towards those barriers that exist, kind of cultural, social barriers, do they still inform kind of your teaching or the way that you want to present your research to the world?
Yeah, I would definitely say, I think it mostly impacts how I present things to like a general public type audience, like within the scientific community, especially within the field of entomology, right? There's less having to kind of explain why you would want to work on a bug, right? That's kind of, we're all bug nerds, so we kind of get that part of it. But when you're talking to the general public, that is a pretty big barrier to overcome, is like, why would you work on how bug wings evolved? Like, who cares? That's not helping anyone. That's not saving a plant from getting eaten by a bug, right? But again, I think going back to that, appreciating these things evolve to do their own little thing in the environment, and like nothing has a purpose, nothing has a higher value than anything else, in my opinion. You know, we're all just pursuing knowledge. And so trying to explain kind of why this is a topic of interest is always really interesting. So kind of my usual approach is talking about, think about how many different bugs there are out there and like how they all look different, and kind of approaching it like, how do you think that happens? Like making them think of the question, like, how do you think a wing evolved? You know, starting to get them to think about their own relationship with arthropods is usually how I approach it. And I have done a decent amount of both outreach and teaching, as you brought up. So when I was in grad school, I taught a non-science majors entomology course. So it was all the students who needed this one unit lab class to graduate that were not science majors. So most of them were not interested in insects. In fact, they like were kind of grossed out. Some of them were like, I don't like insects. Can I still take this class? You know, I'm like, yes. And I'm going to make you like them by the end. So that's kind of my approach, is like decreasing fear through knowledge, right? So the more I can get these people to empathize with insects, to understand that they are animals and they don't have entirely different motivations than us, right? They want to eat. They want to, you know, rest. They want to maximize their fitness, right? It's not all that different than how we experience the world, but through this kind of like artificial hierarchy of values by how close something is to a human, they feel like they're totally different and doing something different. And it's easy to assume it's like malicious intent when they're, you know, flying at you or whatever, when really they're just trying to live their life.
You know, from the position that you've attained within entomology, if you could kind of go back, because yourself as a young person were discouraged from this field, and there'll be many young people currently being discouraged from this field, and many young people who think, I like spiders, but I've been told that spiders are gross and that spiders aren't for little girls, and people who've been told that the thing that they like is dirty, or the thing that they like it indicates some kind of social problem or speaks to a weirdness within them, I guess. And I'm not entirely against weirdness within people in itself. That is in itself to be celebrated, I think. But do you have kind of a message for those young people, for yourself even, people encountering that adversity?
Yeah, so I used to really think it was bad to be weird, right? Like when you're a kid, I think you really want to fit in and feel like you're, you know, part of the group and strive for quote unquote, you know, normalcy. Sure. But as I've gotten older and interacted with more and more people, the people I find myself gravitating towards and the people I find the most interesting and that I have the best relationships with are the people who are just authentically themselves and embrace that weirdness. You know, like I am the weird bug person of many people's lives, and, you know, I fully endorse that. You know, growing up in the 90s, I watched a lot of Magic School Bus. So Miss Frizzle is a really big, hero of mine. And I think her saying, make mistakes, get messy, you know, that really is the best way to pursue life. If that is what your passion is, pursue it. You don't have to do it in like a educational formal sense either. I think, you know, going outside and looking under a rock at a bug, right? That's totally cool and valid. If you want to get a pet tarantula, that's totally cool and valid, right? Just pursuing what your interests are and trying not to worry about the reflection that's going to have for other people, that I think really is the best way forward. And if you happen to be a parent listening to this, I also think even if something that your child is interested in, or any child in your life, even if they're not your child, even if it's not your interest, you know, thinking about how you can empower them to pursue that is very powerful. I'm now in the Connecticut Entomological Society, and it's a meeting that's open to the public. And we had middle schoolers come to our last meeting, and their parents brought them and stayed for the whole meeting. And I went up to them afterwards and talked to them. I was like, you know, I just want to thank you for bringing your kids to this. Like, I wish my parents would have done this. Not that, you know, my parents did a great job with the tools that they had, but, you know, just allowing your child or empowering your child to pursue whatever their interest is, I think is really important. And just checking your own judgment, you know, even if you think something is gross or icky, maybe you don't need to pass that on.
Sure. However difficult that might be for some people, but
yeah,
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that you know, my personal belief is that there is a moral imperative, and it is an act of moral good to see insects as worthwhile and to see invertebrates as worthwhile. Equally, you know, because there is a lot of talk about gotta save the world, gotta save the insects, or all that kind of business, which is great, love it. They're really weird, they're really cool, and I think that's something also to be celebrated.
Yeah, I honestly think anyone who spends the time to look at arthropods can't help but fall in love with them, right? If you're able to check that judgment or phobia or fear that you have coming in and just look at them, right? Like, especially kind of microscopic images or zoomed in images, they're just so fascinating looking, and there's so many different shapes and colors and patterns and textures. Like, you know, humans are visual creatures, and as a human being, like, they're almost like art, you know? I think arthropods are like nature's art, right?
I think that's a very, very astute point. And yeah, so go out, look under rocks, have a look at some nice arthropods. That's the big message and takeaway, I think.
Yeah, and even if it's in your, you know, little snack wrapper from recess, go ahead and catch that bug and look at it up close and then let it go.
Let it go is crucial.
Make an insect collection, right? That's also a good way for people to pursue interest in entomology, right? There's lots of like 4-H clubs here in the United States that do that kind of stuff. But honestly, even getting involved online, right? There's lots of good, you know, podcasts and YouTubes that talk about different aspects of arthropod biology. There's lots of different ways to learn about things, even if it's not like formal education.
Well, thank you so much for, and this is one of those ways, by listening to interviews with people who are kind enough to share their expertise like yourself. So thank you so much for spending the time talking to me about insect flight and about your entomology and your relationship with entomology. It's been an absolute pleasure. So thank you so much, Abby.
Well, thank you for helping to share the invertebrate love. I really appreciate that there are people out there kind of, you know, pursuing this passion and making sure that the general public has access to this sort of information. So thank you.
For what good it is, what am I saying? I've run out of things to say. But thank you. That's a kind thing to say. Yeah. Abby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Grubbing the Filth was written and produced by me, Tom Sharp, with music by Will Hatton. And thanks again to Abby Hayes. You can find Grubbing the Filth on Twitter at GITF Podcast, or Instagram at Grubbing the Filth. You can also email grubbingthefilth@gmail.com. Thank you.